I think there is a weakness in the storytelling of our Torah. Our scripture has a flaw in the way it tells stories. It tells more often than it shows, which is to say, the difference between describing all the rules and regulations and principles of baseball and taking your child to a baseball game. Tell, not show, which would be similar to me telling you, I sound like I have a tubercular cough and me just coughing, which you've heard already. So what is wonderful about that for the sages, for our rabbinic and Jewish enterprise post-biblical era, is that it leaves a lot of room to maneuver. It leaves a lot of room to explain, to think about, to decipher. As Eric Auerbach in Mimesis talks, most of the Torah is backgrounded, or most of the story is backgrounded. The foreground is very slim and slight, and our sages, through the principles of Midrash, are able to infer and make story, make fan fiction out of the rest. This was illustrated very nicely in the likely soon-to-be-completed sessions of Prophets Come Alive. David was there at the inauguration. We're talking about the stories of David as he becomes king, as he heads into the wilderness for his rebel period. But nowhere in Scripture is it understood how David feels about the experience, and we were play-acting it, and we came to the idea that perhaps David was very reticent to be crowned, that it was fearful, as it ought to be. Joseph, likewise, one of the longest sagas in the Torah, if we exclude Moses' development, certainly the longest saga of Genesis. As I've said elsewhere, the longest surah of the Quran is also about Joseph, relying a lot on our Midrashim in Arabia. Joseph, I think one could say, to an extent unlike Jacob, evolves. He clearly could be understood as a callow youth, selfish, narcissistic, egotistical, much like Jacob. But by the end of Joseph's story, he's much more generative, compassionate, and offering, serving than his father. But to grasp that, our sages went a little further. So they note the brothers' regret in this parasha of their actions towards Joseph. And they put, I think, in Reuven's mouth the idea that we did a great disservice. Joseph was a little kid. What did we expect? He wasn't a bad person inherently. He was a teenager. He was a callow youth. His actions were due to the fact that he was immature, childish. Elsewhere we see that Joseph was very fond of his appearance, that he would curl his eyes and lift his heels. Curl his eyebrows, I assume, is to use makeup. Lifting his heels, I've never understood, but I don't know. That's the image I get, which does seem kind of young and flightful. So again, in that sense that we don't see as much as are told, we know in this week's parasha that Joseph has grown to be a man of stature and wisdom and authority. In separate places, he's called Ish Navon V'Chacham, a discerning and wise person, and Sofnat Paneach, which term is very hard, archaic and hard to understand, but our sages, of course, made a lot of bones out of that, made a lot of hay from it. So in these two concepts, they say various things, that Sofnat Paneach, for example, is one that reveals hidden things and declares them, such as Joseph revealing the dreams. One of my favorite lines, I think it's in this week's parasha, is when someone says, "You can interpret dreams, why don't you rule us?" Which I think is a very poor qualification for being the ruler of a nation. But stranger things happen. People less qualified enter into public life. I was thinking of Woodrow Wilson. Obviously. He really never, anyway. Ulysses Grant, I mean, there's many. So Chizkiyahu, Hezekiah, one of our sages, interprets the name Sofnat Paneach as one who reveals, with knowledge, he reveals hidden and sets the minds of people at ease. And then he creates an acronym out of it, that he is Tzofeh, a seer, that he is a Podeh, a rescuer, that he is Navi, a prophet, that he is a Tomech, a supporter, that he is a poter, interpreter, arom, which is the word we used to describe the serpent, a clever, navon, understanding, discerning, and Jose, also a seer, like the Jose of Lublin, the seer of Lublin in the early Hasidic period. So we get the clear sense as told, not always demonstrated or shown or enacted and narrated, that Joseph has grown immensely in wisdom and stature, which is kind of neat. Because by the end of Yaakov's life, he's still acerbic, to say the least. He still is eager to insult the sons that he perceives slight from. But Joseph really forgives, showing a sign of some kind of beautiful maturity. So how? As is my wont, I'm very interested in words that are slippery. We've talked before about the word arrogant, about the word leadership, about terms that we use very commonly, but we don't have a shared definition of. So getting the sense that Joseph has grown in and accumulated wisdom, what is wisdom? Whence does it come? Arnold used to say, he quoted something that intelligence is knowing that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad. It's a good rough definition, at least of those two things in counterpoint. So I'm gonna give you my formula for wisdom as discerned from this week's parasha. Wisdom is experience paired with accountability and compassion. And we're going to see that mostly in the development of the characters in the parasha. So this is a really wonderful midrash I'm going to share with you. So Joseph, you're going to see, if you look in chapter 44, verse 5, that Joseph tells his brethren, "You can't fool me because I'm practiced in divination." But what he actually says is, "I am a snake snaker. I am a snake charmer. I am practiced in observing serpents," which presumably was some sort of method in the ancient world of discerning things, like they used broken glass and they threw bones. That we know, throwing bones is something connected to the Urim and the Tumim. But he who nachesh yenachesh, he is a snake snakery. So our sages have this wonderful story about Jacob, that when the brothers throw them in the pit, it says it was a pit, it was an empty pit. To which redundancy, I mean, it's a pit, why would it not be empty? The sages say, it wasn't completely empty, it was full of snakes and scorpions. Thereby, that was Jacob's Bildungsroman. That was where he grew in his heroic capacities. That was his wilderness, that was his... I'm trying to think of that in the hero cycle, which piece that is in Joseph Campbell's hero cycle. So he learned from experience. And his brethren demonstrate the capacity of accountability to teach us wisdom, that once we discern and account for and attest to our flaws, capacities, once we see ourselves in the round and know what we have done, what we are incapable of doing, what we are good at, what our flaws have been, that is a piece of great wisdom, is self-awareness and that kind of knowledge. So there is a sentence where I think it's Jacob's, in Jacob's mouth, they talk about the blood reckoning that we're going to receive for our brother's death. This is before Joseph doesn't actually reveal himself fully till the beginning of next week's parasha. So they think Joseph is still dead, and the troubles they're having in Egypt are due to this sort of long-term generational reckoning for their ill deeds to Joseph. And they refer to plural bloods. They refer to blood in multiple senses. So Bartanura, one of our medieval sages, among others, says that the two bloods are not just Joseph's, but also Jacob's. That they've caused grievance to their father, probably to Binyamin as well, and to Joseph. That they sold a child into slavery who was not, at least at that point, barely bar mitzvah. That he shouldn't have been, in some ways, accountable for his flaws. But they take an accounting, they take a cheshbon nefesh, of their history, of the ways in which they've screwed up, done wrong, that they've missed the mark. That accountability, as we talked about over the holidays, is always vital. But the other piece of wisdom, experience plus accountability plus compassion, is shown by Joseph to an extent. So I've talked about this before. A very hard piece of this parasha is the fact that Joseph induces the Egyptians to willingly become serfs. You can read over it and gloss over it, but eventually they sell themselves into servitude and indenture themselves to the state, Joseph in particular. That they are impoverished and become more and more reliant on the state, such that they, I think in one literal sense, they become serfs. They go from effectively free people to indentured bondsmen. That's a difficult thing to swallow. That's not where I want to go today, but I do, as I've said before, detest whitewashing our tradition. It's there. Let's be honest about it, but we don't always have to dwell in it. So there is a beautiful interpretation of it. There is this sense that one of the things Joseph requires and demands of the people as they become indebted and dependent upon him is that they circumcise themselves. Because why not? Why not? And there is a sense of that corresponding to the brothers' treatment of the people of Shechem, where they forced, in the Midrash, that Joseph has people circumcise themselves, and then a few days later he welcomes them in for grain and food. This is Midrash is connected to the brothers being in custody for 3 days, but there is that connection as well. So he says the 3 days that the brothers are in custody is akin to the 3 days that the brothers waited for the Shechemites to circumcise themselves and then slaughter them. So the brothers took advantage of the Shechemites, the people of Shechem, to slaughter them, whereas Joseph does the opposite. He compels the Egyptians to circumcise them and then proceeds to sustain them, which is one of the things that archaeologists or linguists or students of the ancient world think Tzofenat Paneach might have really meant, the sustainer of the people. So he does wise. He does a kindness. He doesn't entirely, at least in the Zohar's understanding, that was from the Zohar, doesn't abuse his power, but cultivates compassion to those he serves and to those who are reliant upon him. That the people in this parasha learn to be accountable. They learn to recognize their experiences as a source of strength, and through that grow in compassion and, of course, wisdom. So I'm going to conclude with this piece from the Kav Chen. I talked to Reb Wilhelm about this. There are sages whom we know by name but know very little about. It's likely the Kav Chen was someone one of the early middle generations of the Hasidic movement, but it's not so clear. All that Reb Wilhelm could say was that his name was Yosef Noach, he thinks. Couldn't find him anywhere. So there is this fraught moment towards the end of the parasha where the brothers are about to drink and Joseph is briefly alone with them, to which our sages, you might not even think about this, note how dangerous that is. That Joseph being alone with these strangers whom he knows to be his brothers but whom he knows to potentially have great enmity, the sages say they could have just kicked him to death. A good swift kick might have done him in. And elsewhere the sages note that Joseph's brethren drink from the cup. Which if you've ever watched Game of Thrones or any sort of historical drama, you know, they had tasters because of poisons. Those were moments to exact revenge that neither side took the opportunity to do. So why did they trust each other? What was the nascent trust that appears at the end of the parsha? Remember, before they really see each other, before Joseph reveals himself completely, taking off his makeup, I guess, Joseph. So he noticed that he had given Benjamin, a double portion of the meal. And he noticed, interestingly, I think about this, like that it was a dangerous thing to do. It was the precedent in Torah again and again is that twins and brotherly envy are very toxic. But he noticed he gave Binyamin special treatment and the brothers were not jealous. They were viciously and vehemently and aggressively jealous of Yosef's special treatment from Yaakov. When Joseph received the coat and special love and adornments from Jacob, that jealousy drove them to distraction, to violence. But he watched that when Binyamin was given a special piece in the meal, they didn't react. There's no textual evidence that they moved an inch, an iota. They had grown. They had all grown. I struggle with the Joseph stories. I often find them, for some reason, dull. I'm not attracted to the characters. And there is precedent for that. Our sages didn't think very highly of Joseph. But as I'm looking through the Parsha this week, it has a beautiful narrative. It has a beautiful arc. Because it really is one of the few places where we see dissolution and coming together, struggle, callow youth becoming whole on both sides. That's a lovely thing. And that culmination of wisdom through experience, accountability, and compassion. It's really quite stunning. And only through that will we have the denouement next week when we see Joseph reveal himself. There had to be trust built. I want to think about that. I don't know exactly what I want to say, but I made a note to myself to think about Hanukkah. Because that's the message. That's not the message. This parsha always goes with Hanukkah. These parshiot about Joseph are always at Hanukkah time. And Hanukkah, to an extent like the Joseph story, is not an easy one. As much as it's about, in your mind, the miracle of the oil, and that's what our sages thought about in Talmud because they didn't quite understand the holiday. It was relatively new even to the era of the Mishnah. It's a religious purge. It's a vicious near civil war. And we like to think about it as this revolt against the Seleucid Greeks, but in a lot of ways it was brother against brother. It was the rise of the Hasmonean dynasty, brief though it might have been, and a crushing of people who had Hellenized ways and a purge of those same people. Our people are fraught. Our people are divisive, ornery, fractious. But like Hanukkah, like Joseph and his brothers, there is the potential for redemption through Ahavat Chinam, through causeless love of brother to brother, and through returning and through opening of the heart to each other. And in this dark time, both literally and metaphorically, I mean, the reason I'm trying to explain to my children, and I mentioned it at preschool yesterday, the reason Jews and Christians light lights for Christmas and Hanukkah is, I think, an atavistic fear of the dark. So around the solstice, we bring candles out. And maybe that's the message of the Parsha and Hanukkah, is that even in challenging times, even at times of tribalism, civil war, brother against brother, maybe there is hope that is held out in the darkness.